and welcome to Staff Picks, the podcast for movie nerds by movie nerds. As always, I'm Mario Lanza, and I am your host on our journey through the movies out there that just need a little more love. And our movie today, oh boy, this is going to be a fun one. This is not the type of movie I generally cover on Staff Picks. This is a musical. This is a, well, there's many other words I will use to describe it later in the podcast. But we are talking about the 1980, some would say flop, some would say cult hit, Xanadu, starring Olivia Newton-John in her very first starring role, which is a musical about roller disco. So if you'd like to turn off the podcast and go to a different episode, this would be a good time to do that. But if you would like to hear me talk about a very bizarre movie that I happen to be very fond of for some odd reason, then keep listening, because this is going to be a fun episode. And my guest for this one, I will say I have been wanting to do a Xanadu podcast for like 4 years, and it was always a matter of finding the right person to come on who really liked it like I did and wanted to talk about it, and who I knew would be able to get into the spirit of this episode. So I'm bringing back one of my favorite guests. I've had her on at least 2 times before, maybe 3. I forget if we've done 4 or 3 episodes. But let's see. She is a podcaster over on the Rob Has a Podcast Network. She is very well known, very snarky and funny. We have a fun banter because we've known each other for like 20 years. But I had to bring her back when I found out she was a Xanadu fan. So welcome back to Staff Picks, Jessica Lease.
Hey, I'm a Fanadu, Mario.
A Fanadu, is that the official term?
I think it is not good enough to be an official term.
So you're not the fan to the extent that you're like join all the live retro or live events where they put on costumes and stuff, right? Like those?
I have never shadow casted Xanadu. No.
Okay. Before we get into Xanadu, and I'm telling people already, this is going to be a bizarre episode. So get ready. This is maybe one of the weirdest episodes I've ever done. But Jessica, kind of remind people who you are and why you were selected for this particular movie.
Well, I thought I was selected for this particular movie because literally nobody else would watch it with you, but I am a person who enjoys a good musical. I'm a person who enjoys a bad movie, and I enjoy roller skating, and this soundtrack utterly slaps.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What else should we say about it?
I'll leave this up to you, because I have my own list, which may not be anything like your list.
Yeah, I mean, also, one of my all-time favorite movies, like since I was a child, was Singin' in the Rain. And so Gene Kelly on the screen can literally do no wrong, although he sure tried in this movie.
Yeah, I was going to challenge you on that one. He's never done wrong, yet he was in Xanadu.
Yes. I mean, Gene Kelly is an interesting figure, and we will get into it. Why was he doing this? Like, what bet did he lose?
Okay, let me paint a picture for my listeners, just who may have not seen this movie. And I hate to prejudge my audience, but I'm guessing the average Staff Picks listener is not a fan of do like Jessica here.
Well, Mario, I have to say, describing something that I watched so other people don't have to, like, that's been how I have covered The Walking Dead for like 8 years at this point.
I also heard you did what? The Amazing Race Canada?
Yes, Amazing Race Canada. That one I think people do watch. Like, I think we're very big in Canada, but Walking Dead, I would say 3/4 of the people I talk to about it on any given day are just like, I don't watch it anymore. I just listen to you guys talk about it.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, you know, I actually get a lot of people on Staff Picks that say that. They're like, I'm never going to watch these movies. I just like hearing you talk about them.
Yeah, we are doing a public service here. We are contributing to the collective cultural literacy.
Well, yeah, and I mean, you joke about that, but I do take that very seriously, that I'm helping teach people about movies that may disappear. Like, this may never show up on a streaming service. This doesn't feel like a Netflix movie that's going to get a big revival again one day.
Yeah, I had to pay $4 to watch it on Amazon.
Wow, I had to pay almost $2 for the DVD I bought on eBay.
Dang, I should have just bought the DVD. Yeah. Then I could watch it all I want. I think I did watch it all I wanted.
Well, but you didn't get all the special features like I did. There's lots of extra stuff on the DVD.
Yeah, well, I saw the picture you put up of the menu, and that's like a quality early DVD menu.
Okay, okay. We're going to take lots of digs at each other and this movie as it goes along. But we do both, I would imagine, possess a genuine love for this movie, at least to some extent, right?
Oh, yeah. It's very sentimental. And I would say, like, we were joking around before we even watched it for this podcast. You said it's like 60% music.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, and it's 39% vibes. Mm-hmm.
That is an excellent way to... Yeah, excellent way to describe it, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, it's a world that you kind of, you know, it's a place that nobody dared to go. It's a world you want to inhabit.
Wow.
There you are, shooting star.
That was an excellent transition. I have to give you credit to that one. Okay, she's quoting the song, by the way, if you guys don't know that. But okay, so Xanadu is a roller disco musical that is very, very much a product of its time, 1980. It was probably filmed in 1979. There's a lot of late 70s in this. There's a lot of disco. There's neon. It's a very much a movie of its time. But the one thing I always have to point out to people, now, Jessica, you know this, obviously, there were a lot of weird-ass musicals being produced around that time. So this movie was not that odd at the time because there were other movies kind of like it.
Yes, but this was particularly audacious. I think they started out, they were just going to make this like a deliberately crappy musical, and then somehow it just spiraled.
Wait, so you're saying this one's particularly audacious when it was only a year after the Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band musical?
P.S. The next time I come on Staff Picks, I want to do that.
Oh, excellent. I've been looking for a host for that one, too.
Oh, yeah. That's another sentimental fave of mine. It apparently, like, you know, it tripled the budget that it was supposed to have, and it just, I don't even know what they were thinking. There's got to be a good book about this somewhere, and I'm gonna go read it at some point. So don't quote me as the authoritative source on all things Xanadu history, but I do know that it just, like, it's one of those fiascos that just, like, careened out of control, and all of a sudden they want it to be this huge breakout hit, and it goes nowhere because there are so many crappy musicals to choose from in the late 70s.
Okay, yeah. I, as the purchaser of the DVD, got to see the little special feature that you probably didn't get to see that explains exactly what you just talked about. So, yeah, so there were a lot of these weird-ass musicals that came out in the late 70s, Sgt. Pepper's one. I'm a big fan of The Apple, which is even worse than Xanadu, but The Apple is also another one. They just love these big-ass gay musicals, and I say that in the most positive way possible. There's a huge gay following of this movie, and I will go into that in a minute. But, yeah, these huge musical dance extravaganzas. And because Olivia Newton-John was coming off Grease and she was in there with John Travolta, they were like, well, you know, she could co-star in a movie. What if she could star in a movie? So this was like the big jump where she could do it all by herself. And like Jessica said, they had written this little tiny script. It was just a little movie, just an homage to roller disco, which was a big thing going on in the late 70s. And then all of a sudden, the Olivia Newton-John, her people contacted them and said she would like to do this movie. And they're like, well, that wasn't our plan because we don't have a budget for, you know, the biggest singing star in the world to star in our movie. But they're like, she really wants to do it. She thinks she'd be good. She wants to lead a movie. So she got involved. Then for whatever odd reason, Gene Kelly, the star of Singing in the Rain from, you know, 40 years before that, he said he'd like to be in it too. And they're like, this was not the movie we planned it to be. And it grew into something so huge and out of control. And again, I'll just say it straight out. This was a big flop, but it's kind of developed a cult following since then.
Yeah, it's up there in like the all-time big flops. Like it's up there with like Ishtar and Heaven's Gate as like these huge fiascos. And honestly, a lot of these fiasco movies, like you watch them in a vacuum and they're fine. They're fun. Mm-hmm. Like my favorite fiasco, John Carter. That movie's great, but it's a fiasco.
Yeah, that these fiascos, they can be fun if viewed in the right context. And what's funny is I was looking this up, Jessica, that this movie obviously a notorious flop. A lot of these musicals were notorious flops, but this wasn't that bad a flop. I think the budget was like $22 million and it made $25 million. So like, wasn't that bad a flop?
So it made money.
Barely.
What you're saying.
Yeah, barely.
There's plenty of movies that don't even do that.
But I always felt bad because, like, everyone involved with it, it, like, torpedoed their career. Like, I read that Olivia Newton-John was never again offered a movie where she was the lead. She had to co-star after this, so this torpedoed her real bad. The guy Michael Beck, who plays Sonny, it completely ruined his career.
Yeah, he did two good movies. That was it.
Yeah, that was it. This was the second one.
Yeah. And Gene Kelly never did another movie. It killed Gene Kelly.
It killed your idol, Gene Kelly.
He was alive for, like, another 20, like 15 years after this. And he never did another movie.
That's the one you really want to go out on, is the roller disco movie.
Hey, you know what? I honestly, Xanadu might have been Gene Kelly's karmic retribution for how badly he treated everyone in Singing in the Rain.
Okay, we'll come back to that later, because I don't know that story. You are the sole gatekeeper of this knowledge.
Oh boy, yes. Oh,
okay.
Am I ever.
And the other thing about this movie that's interesting, again, this was such an embarrassing flop for its time, yet it has a killer soundtrack, which Jessica mentioned, maybe my all-time favorite movie soundtrack, like of any movie ever. I've listened to this soundtrack so many times. So despite everything not working in this movie, it somehow still kind of works, and it was kind of beloved. In fact, oh, that one more thing I wanted to add is that I was listening to this on the DVD commentary that they said the producers were like, you know, this movie shouldn't have worked. But it kind of did. When you saw it in an audience, they actually get into it and people escape into this weird fantasy. And the main producer of the movie said, we were supposed to open in 900 theaters. That was the deal. But then the studio at the last minute changed their mind and we only opened in 250 theaters. Mm. And he said, and that was the problem. That's why we didn't make money. But if you looked at those 250 theaters, they were making money and people were having fun. And he's like, and we had the number one hit song in the world. We had Magic by Olivia Newton-John. The soundtrack was selling. He's like, the problem with the movie wasn't that it flopped. It was that the studio just didn't put it out there enough. And that was his argument to what really happened.
I mean, I hear a lot of people making that same argument for things that are worse than this and people buy it. So I guess a lot of entertainment is marketing when you really think about it.
Oh yeah. Marketing and timing, really.
Yeah. I will say though, I think one strike against it is the title.
Mm-hmm.
Like the fact they keep saying Xanadu, and it's really, I feel like Samuel Taylor Coleridge might be a weird hook to hang your roller disco movie on.
How dare you bring up that? Yeah, no, you're right.
I mean, it worked fine for Citizen Kane, but that's Citizen Kane. This is not Citizen Kane.
Yeah, my wife was commenting the same thing. We were watching this and she could not like this movie any less, by the way. She wanted nothing to do with it. Nobody in my family understands my fascination with this movie. But my wife has pointed out, she loves that poem and she loves Xanadu. She's like, why is it called Xanadu? Because the movie's all about Greek mythology. And I'm like, that's a wonderful point. I'm not sure why they chose the Xanadu. When they went in the Chinese myth? It's I forget the name, but it's not Greek. Like, what? They're mixing up mythology a lot in this movie.
Yeah, but so is Coleridge. I mean, he was probably stoned off his gourd when he wrote that poem in the first place. But I think it's supposed to be like this majestic, like unreachable dream thing. It's a little bit about hubris, and we have a lot of hubris in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in this movie and outside of it, we're going to break the fourth wall here.
You know, there's a lot of hubris in us doing this podcast.
I'm not arguing that point.
Okay, so I want to talk about our history with this movie, because I'm sure we both come at this movie from very unique places. I would like to hear how you, as a young girl growing up in Montana, somehow discovered Xanadu.
Well, I didn't discover it as a child. I discovered it as a young adult, because I had a best friend who was very into this movie. And I like bad movies. I have a secret soft spot for the movies that people say are bad. And, you know, Mystery Science Theater 3000 was something I grew up with. And so I like nothing better than to find something that has the reputation of being terrible and either finding the secret good in it or making fun of it or both.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew the music. Like, I loved Olivia Newton-John. You know, if you're a small child in the 80s, I think you can't escape her. And I very much loved this era of movies. I love the aesthetic. I feel like a lot of good things came out of 1979,
mm-hmm.
Myself included. So it was kind of a slam dunk for me, and I really latched onto it when I did see it.
Okay, so you didn't see it as a kid, and neither,
no.
Yeah, neither did I. I have heard that kids that grew up with this movie become very protective of it, and they love it. Like, this is it's a very good movie for little kids because there's like bright colors and it's a very simple plot. So I was just curious about that.
So my question for you is, do you want me to indoctrinate my own child?
I would love. I mean, I don't have to deal with the fallout of this, so I would love to see you do it. Yeah,
I will. I will let you know what he says.
Okay, I indoctrinated my kids into this movie, and they both hate it. So there you go. In fact, my kids to this day, I was going to bring this up, make fun of me, and that I've been told this ever since I was, I mean, for many years, that, Dad, you're gay and you just don't know it yet. I've been told that many times as a kid by my own kids, and this movie is exhibit A. They're like, how could you like Xanadu and claim to just be a straight guy? I don't get it. My own children will tell me that, so this is where it leads.
Well, you know, it's a spectrum.
it is a spectrum. I'm somewhere on the spectrum.
Like, we don't know. It might shift your Kinsey number over a little bit to like this movie.
Yes. Although I should point out that my son has long pointed out, Dad, you're gay, you just don't realize it. But it's not Xanadu that's his number one argument. And this other one might be even worse, because I also love ABBA.
Yeah, but ABBA is amazing.
I agree.
That's just good taste.
I agree. You're arguing, you're preaching to the choir here. I love ABBA, but my son will never let me hear the end of that.
I mean, that's well-crafted pop music. I think what you like here, I don't think you're responding to, like, also, none of the dudes in this movie are terribly hot. Oh. So I don't know if it makes you gay to like it.
Yeah. Well, okay, let me point this out for people who think we're veering into a weird area. This movie, I was reading about it all on the internet the other day, that, you know, it came out and it was, you know, middling fun. But then over the years, since the 80s, it developed this enormous gay following, like a lot of musicals do. So this is considered one of the, like, if you're gay of that era, you love Xanadu. It's just expected. So this movie has a huge following.
Yeah. I mean, I guess Michael Beck can get it. But Olivia Newton-John, she really does give that kind of iconic energy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would love to see, I'd love to see a drag show about Xanadu, honestly. I'm sure there are many.
There you go. You live in New York. I'm sure there's got to be every corner there should be one.
Probably go outside, throw a rock. I can hit a drag show about Xanadu.
Okay, let me talk about my history with this movie, growing up as a non-gay boy in the late 70s that somehow loved Xanadu. I actually didn't know about this movie until the late 90s. Like, I'd maybe heard of it. And the thing that got me is that, and this always makes people laugh when I explain this, VH1 used to have this show, I Love the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of my favorite things of all time. I still have all those on DVD. I just watch that endlessly. I just love that whole series. But I remember in the 1980 episode, they had a whole segment on Xanadu.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember that.
And they had a lot of celebrities who were very reluctant to point out that they kind of liked Xanadu. And I just remember that segment in particular just being funny, because you had like Hal Sparks and Timothy Busfield and Leah Thompson all taking digs at Xanadu, but they all secretly knew every little detail about it. And I thought that was so funny. So I'm like, I should probably check out this movie. So that was my history, is watching Hal Sparks take digs at it, but secretly love it too.
Yeah. Remember when VH1 was like 24/7, just like snarky talking heads talking about pop culture?
Absolutely.
That was a great era. That was the best era.
I love late 90s TV. Late 90s TV was my favorite.
Yeah. I think, like, I would argue that TV just went to hell when Survivor premiered.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Survivor did good things. It may have done some bad things too. Yeah, reality TV eventually took over. But yeah, snarky talking heads. And it wasn't just VH1. I was just thinking this. It was everything. I was thinking like a Sports Center was a big thing. It was just snarky anchors. Even people that didn't watch sports would just tune in to watch these funny guys make jokes. And then The Daily Show with Craig Kilborn, you had Norm MacDonald. Like, this was the birth of all just snark.
Yeah. Yeah, it was an era. I would say, like, snark kind of died in about 2008. Because you had this period with the intersection of reality TV and snark, and everybody got too mean, and it sort of, like, turned everybody's stomachs. And then, you know, the lost art of snark. I feel like you and I are resurrecting an ancient art form. It's like the muse is visiting us.
Yeah, well, the muse, yes.
Came off the mural and came down to help us snark about this movie.
Okay, I have to talk about it. Now, obviously, any fanadoo out there knows what Jessica's referring to. But yeah, the plot of this movie, and I'm going to be very liberal with the term plot, but the plot of this movie is thus, that a Greek muse comes down and teaches a struggling artist in Los Angeles to follow his dream to open a roller disco with an old man. It sounds silly, almost sounds silly when you explain it like that.
Yeah, I mean, who would make a movie of that?
Yes. Based on a true story, by the way. No, not.
No.
Okay, we're going to get into this movie and our, again, somewhat reluctant love of it. I every time I watch this movie, I'm entranced by how unabashedly late 70s it is, and they're really, again, it might not come off on screen, but they're having so much fun making it. That's something that I always notice when I watch it.
Yeah, it's true. And I, again, to contrast it with something like Singing in the Rain, like, everybody is flawless in that movie, mm-hmm. but I don't think they had very much fun. And this is like, well, what do you want to do today? Oh, I think I want to roller skate in a garage. Okay, let's do it.
Let's add some neons, special effects around them. Make them glow. As Mo Rocca said on I Love the 70s, or I Love the 80s, it's like everyone in this movie has ingested vast amounts of barium.
This was cutting edge for the time, by the way.
It was, yeah. And this movie looks embarrassing when you watch it now, but this is like the peak of coolness. Like, this was all the hip fashion of the time. These were all the best choreographers in Hollywood, all the hot dancers putting numbers together. So, like, this is what would have passed for cool in 1980, and that's one thing I think that needs to be pointed out.
Yeah, and it is a beautiful movie. Like, I was doing kind of a deep dive on some of the production elements, and it's stuff that you don't really think about, like the way that they drop in these kind of super hyper realistic sky backgrounds to make it look like it's just, you know, just this side of the uncanny valley. It's like, it's hyper real, and the color schemes are very on point. I mean, there's one or two scenes where I have a lot of quibbles about, like, the production design and how it looks, mm-hmm. because I think it looks kind of cheesy, but for the most part, the sort of dream world that they inhabit is really well realized and beautiful, and you know what it is. Like, you can look at this and you know what it, you know, it's Xanadu. It's, you know, it's not something else.
Yeah, this is not Greece. That's a whole different universe here than Greece.
Yeah. Well, Greece is its own thing, but
Greece is the word. That's what I heard.
Here's my controversial hot take. This movie's better than Greece.
You know, I was actually going to ask that question because I would lean in that direction as well. I was going to say, how do you compare and contrast Grease? Because it's almost, for people who don't know, it's almost impossible not to compare these two movies because they're Olivia Newton-John's first two, and they're both musicals, and they're both odd with very distinct soundtracks. I don't love Grease as much as most people do, and I love Xanadu more than most people do. So that's not such a hot take with me.
Yeah, I didn't think it would be with you. I think it is in general, though. I think you and I are on our own island here.
Just me, you, and Hal Sparks. Yeah.
Yeah, me, you, and Hal Sparks. It is a place where nobody else dared to go.
Yes. Okay, a little bit of trivia here. When I first started putting together this podcast, I thought this was the first musical I had ever covered on Staff Picks. It turns out it's not. My daughter pointed out she did The Wicker Man with me, and the original Wicker Man is technically a musical.
So, what?
It is. It's considered a musical. There's like 6 songs in it.
Oh, wow. 6 whole songs.
Yeah, I know. But then someone else pointed out, no, you covered South Park the movie, which is 100% a musical. So,
oh, yeah, 100%. Okay.
So this is not my first musical. Although, this is, I was reading a bunch of reviews of this movie from 1980, and one of the most savage reviews I read is someone wrote, this is what happens when straight people try to plan a musical.
That's not where I thought you were going with that. I thought you were going to go with the one that just said Xanadon't.
Xanadon't is another one. Roger Ebert did not like this movie, not surprisingly. Although, he actually made some interesting points, and this is kind of interesting. He was pointing out the choreography in the movie. He's like, I don't mind musicals. Musicals are okay. There's a fine tradition of musicals. But he said, the choreography in this movie and the filming of it is very poorly done. And he said the reason why is because it's all filmed from far away or from like a waist up when they're filming the dancers. And he's like, it's not like, it looks very muddled. You don't see what the dancers in the back are doing, because when you're just looking at it from straight above, from straight on and not from above, you don't see all the choreography. So he actually was making a good point that it's just not very well photographed. It doesn't maximize like the dance stuff.
Yeah, and there's an entire musical number where Olivia Newton-John is not doing anything. Mm-hmm. She's just standing there, mouthing the words, not even moving her hands. And it's one tracking shot the whole time.
Wait, which one is that? Is that Xanadu?
No, it's not Xanadu. It's near the end. I should have written down which one it was, but it was just like all she did was stand there. And I'm like, do something. Dance. Sway. I don't care.
I also read on the DVD that Gene Kelly was very upset because he does his own roller skating in this movie. And once again, I should point out, this is the type of movie we're talking about. Gene Kelly does his own roller skating.
I love that that's a sentence you can say and everybody knows immediately what you're talking about.
Yes. But Gene Kelly was very upset because in the whole final scene in Xanadu, when he's roller skating, they show him from the waist up. And he's like, nobody can see I'm actually doing the skating. And he was like legitimately pissed about that.
Yeah, and then sometimes they shoot it from far away. And it's like, that could be any dude with gray hair. How do we know that's Gene Kelly?
Yes. Okay, we're about to go into Xanadu here. God help us. Mm-hmm. Okay, so get ready to be entranced by a world of magic and whimsy and neon and Greek muses that for some reason have Australian accents, which I don't understand.
Hey, you know. She lived on Earth for many different cycles.
Yes. Although this movie actually does remind me of something that happened to me in real life once. You might find this interesting.
Oh, was this the time that you were at the roller disco and you ran into Gene Kelly playing his beach clarinet?
Yeah, I did that once. That happens to anybody in L.A. You hang around L.A. long enough, you'll eventually run into the beach clarinet guys. But there was a time when a Greek muse came down from the heavens and blue-balled me and then forced me to open a roller disco. It strikes me as being very similar to this movie.
Yeah, it's like the time my ex showed up with her new boyfriend and made us go into business together and then just pretended she didn't know me.
Wow, people who know the movie will really appreciate that joke. That's a good joke.
Yeah. Well, let's tell people what happens in the movie so they can be in on the joke.
Okay, here we go. Xanadu, please bear with us. This is going to be a weird podcast, but this is a fun movie. So, again, this is the story of a guy named Sonny Malone. That's his last name, right? I forgot to write.
Yeah.
Okay, Sonny Malone, played by Michael Beck. Michael Beck was fresh off The Warriors, right? That was his other movie?
Yeah, and this is a great 70s cult classic double feature, by the way. Like, watch this back to back with The Warriors, and I feel like it's one continuous. It's like the Biggie and Tupac of 1970s.
Just like that. That's exactly the words I would have used.
One of them is West Coast, one of them is East Coast.
Well, you know what's funny is Michael Beck wasn't actually the one they Olivia Newton-John wanted as her co-star. Did you read the trivia who she wanted?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there was some wild stuff here.
All right, who do you have on your list?
She wanted Peter Frampton.
Peter Frampton. That's the same one that I have, yeah.
Yeah. And actually, I have in my notes, and we've already covered this, but it says in my notes, I have the thing from IMDb, and it says, and then in parentheses, it says, also, Mario, if you want me to do that movie, I'm totally down, regarding Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
I was just going to say that. Yeah, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, one of the biggest flops in movie history. It's way worse than Xanadu. So any shit that Xanadu gets, that movie deserves it way more. But that movie, surprisingly, also has a really great soundtrack, and it never gets enough credit for it.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those – I feel like this is something – this was an early 2000s trend, too, was like the movie soundtrack that's just other people covering the same band. This was like the first – soundtrack album that was all big stars covering one band. And yeah, it slaps. I do own this one on DVD.
Okay, good. I actually don't. I have to get this. You've defeated me in this one.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So Sgt. Pepper came out at 78, 79. I forget the year. Huge flop, headlined by Peter Frampton and the Bee Gees as the stars. And that movie was such a notorious flop. No movie would allow Peter Frampton to be the lead ever again. So Olivia Newton-John wanted Peter Frampton for Xanadu. Every studio, every executive said, not a chance in hell that guy's ever leading a movie again. So yeah, so they were stuck with Michael Beck.
I really feel like if I had a time machine and a lot of money and I could go back in time, I would like, in like 1982, I would put Olivia Newton-John and Peter Frampton in a movie together, like just to see what happened.
Absolutely. You have to.
Could I make something bigger than Sergeant Pepper and Xanadu combined?
You're really testing the gods with that one.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, when the muse is with you, the muse is with you.
Yes. Okay. So here we go. The story is Sonny Malone. He's an artist played by Michael Beck, who you probably won't recognize unless you've seen the Warriors. I personally think he does a good job in this movie. Every review of the time thought otherwise, apparently.
He's fine. He's okay. He's not the most interesting, but he gets the job done.
He does his own roller skating, which I think was 90% of the job.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine making this movie and hiring someone who couldn't roller skate?
Yes. That would be a very poor, even by Xanadu standards, that would be a poor production choice.
Yep, Xanderds, as we call them.
Yes. Okay, so Sonny Malone is an artist living in Santa Monica in Los Angeles. Again, this is a very Los Angeles movie, by the way, so Jessica's going to hate it because I know you don't know the West Coast very well, but I will be sure to point out all the local landmarks in this movie.
I mean, I've been there once, like 18 years ago.
All right, so you're basically a local.
Yeah, basically I'm a local. So, yeah, we need to talk about Sonny Malone's job.
All right, yeah, you explain what Sonny Malone does for a living. This is actually based on reality. I didn't know people did this, but apparently this was a real job back in the late 70s.
This is a thing people got paid to do, and they made an actual salary, which really seems wild to me now. But, you know, I live in 2024. He works in, like, this art garage situation, and he is employed by a record label. And his job is to take an album cover and make a big painting of it so they can hang it up in a record store. And I feel like even in 1979, there had to be a lot of easier and cheaper ways to do this.
I know. They didn't have big Xerox copiers and stuff back then.
They didn't. Like, I know large format printing wasn't widespread until the 2000s. But surely, I even tried to, like, research how do they make billboards? Could we, like, blow up a photo that big? I feel like we could have.
I mean, the albums were selling so well in the 70s, you didn't really need a picture of the album out on Tower Records. You could literally just write, "We have Rod Stewart inside," and I'm sure it would sell just as many records.
I'm sure it would be fine. But you also don't need to hire a professional either. Like, you can get whoever is, like, doing the pictures of the pineapples in the grocery store window.
All right, yeah, so Sonny is an artist, as Jessica said, who replicates album covers. He gets an album cover from Airflow Records. I even wrote that down. And they say, here, make a big version of this. So we have all these painters in a garage that just paint things. And Sonny is very frustrated by this because he wants to paint his own visions. He doesn't like replicating other people's visions. And he always gets yelled at work because he's too much of a free thinker, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's like, okay, you're the one that's hiring artists. I don't know what you think you're expecting here. But apparently, like, Sonny's deal is he tried to make it as an artist, and he failed. And so now he has to come with his hat in his hand back to the record label to go into the art garage and paint more records. And, you know, at least you get to paint, dude. At least you're not waiting tables. Like, maybe you should be a little more grateful.
That's true. So you find flaws with the character of Sonny.
Yeah, not to mention, and we're going to get into it because – I feel like his dream is to paint. When does this guy ever freaking paint?
Okay, so we'll get into the plot. So Sonny has been hired to paint, and one day he's working on some album cover or something in his studio, and he doesn't like it. He's like, this is crap, and he tears it up, and he rips into a million bunch of little pieces, and he flings them out his window, and this will set into motion the chain of events that leads to the introduction of the Greek muses into Los Angeles.
Remember, kids, littering is good.
Littering may summon Olivia Newton-John.
Oh, maybe it's not good.
No, maybe not now. That didn't more... I don't want to make a Walking Dead joke, but that's where I was about to go.
Oh, that got dark real fast.
Sorry.
Oh, that's not that's not okay.
We love Olivia Newton-John, one of the most beloved entertainers and performers of all time. Have you ever heard anybody say a bad word about Olivia Newton-John as I try to cheer this up a little bit?
I have not. She is an icon. She's She's gorgeous and talented. She has a beautiful singing voice. We've talked about Grease. We've talked a little bit about Xanadu in this podcast about Xanadu. We haven't talked about Physical, which is a great song. Like, that's the Olivia Newton-John that I grew up with, was Olivia Newton-John doing aerobics and singing Physical.
Oh, yeah. No, I love her. She's like one of the cutest women ever. Just absolutely adorable, sunny personality, always happy. I just loved her as a kid. You know, there's another movie she did with John Travolta. Do you know her second one?
I did know this, but now I don't.
As a kid, I liked this movie, and I don't know how it would hold up, but it's called Two of a Kind. And it's all about, if I recall, it's like ghosts coming down from the heavens and trying to set up Travolta and Olivia Newton-John. Guess what? Another flop. Olivia did not do well with these movies after Grease.
Maybe Olivia should have done something a little more grounded and stopped like trying to dabble in the supernatural.
Yes. Although perhaps some of it is not to, again, once say bad things about Ms. Newton-John, but perhaps part of it was the Sean Connery thing where every role, same accent. Maybe that was the problem.
Could be a problem, but I don't really think her accent's not that grating to me.
Mm-hmm. It's not. It stands out. That's about it.
There are much worse Australian accents, or more, not worse, but more egregious, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, she's not doing an accent. That's how she really talked. No, she's not doing
shtick.
That's
how she really talked. Yeah, and she's not, it's not like, it's not thick as butter.
Like, throw shrimp on the barbie. She's not doing that.
No, she's not doing that.
Okay, so now we've saved the reputation of Olivia Newton-John. All right, so she's about to be summoned into Los Angeles. And
With litter,
yeah. And I should warn you, this is where the movie's about to get weird. For the first time.
I this doesn't even register as weird with me anymore. Like, it's just vibes at this point.
Yeah, this is just Xanadu. Okay, so explain how she and her 8 sisters come to life.
Well, they are living on a giant brick wall. They are a mural, and the pieces of litter hit the mural, and then they all come to life, and in the background is a very literal song describing that they are alive. It is a bop.
Okay, let's talk about this. So this movie is very, you know, infamous for Olivia Newton-John, her contributions to the soundtrack, which, I mean, there's a reason this soundtrack was huge. It's mostly Olivia Newton-John, but it's not all Olivia Newton-John. Let's talk about the other band that was very important to this movie. This is the Electric Light Orchestra. Now, are you an ELO fan the way you're a fan of do?
I'm not like a huge fan, but they're important. I like their music. I think they're good.
Okay. I'm going to expound on that just a little bit, just because I probably like ELO a little more than you do.
I think you do, but you're a bit older than I am.
Yeah, I'm a bit older. But so I was a big fan of the Beatles, as most people were. I went through a huge Beatles phase, and I remember reading a quote somewhere, and I forget if it was George Harrison or John Lennon or someone that said, you know, when we broke up and we stopped doing what we did, there was another band that just continued doing what we were doing, and that was Electric Light Orchestra. He's like, they're basically the Beatles. And he was pointing out in the continuity of music of the time, just watch everything the Beatles did up till 1970, then watch how Jeff Lynne and ELO takes over. And if you're a Beatles fan, you really should consider them almost kind of the same timeline. So that's why I think ELO is very important in music history, and that's why I like this movie so much that they're involved, because every one of their songs in this movie, like you said, it's a bop. Like, it's, I know you don't love them all, but even the ones you don't love, they're still catchy.
Oh yeah, they're great. And of course, Jeff Lynne, also member of the Traveling Wilburys, and you have to love that. Yeah, I mean I think the music really saves this movie. Like, if it was just some rando writing this music, it would not be successful, because there is no plot, and the performances are kind of, I mean, they're having fun, they're enjoying themselves, but I think the fact that these are really well-crafted songs that are, like, lyrically interesting and catchy, I think that really accounts for a lot. Like, you know, we said at the top of the podcast, the songs were not the problem. The songs did very, very well commercially. We had 2 number one hits out of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. If you take this movie and take out the biggest singing star in the world and you take out a number one smash hit soundtrack, then it's basically the Apple. So, yes, it is. I believe the music, yes, does somewhat save this movie, and it's really good. And I know you're not a big ELO fan as me, but at the time when this movie came out, it was kind of famous because half the soundtrack was Electric Light Orchestra on one side of the album, the other half was Olivia Newton-John on the other side, and like either one of those albums would have been a huge hit, but combined they were huge.
Yeah, yeah, it's fantastic. You might even say, you know, you have to believe they're magic.
You do, yes. Suddenly, I'd even say that suddenly. Okay, so yeah, so there's a painting of these nine Greek muses on the wall in Venice Beach for whatever reason. I don't know why that would happen, but you know, in Venice, it kind of does make sense.
Yeah, well, you got to tell them the really upsetting thing about this mural, Mario.
I didn't learn this until recently, but yeah, there's this very famous mural in the movie. It's a purple background with these nine beautiful women in it, and it's very iconic. For years, thought that was a real mural. I thought if you go to Venice, you could still find that, and it was like a movie location, but it was never actually a real mural, and that actually pissed me off when I learned that, because I love movie locations. It was just a normal wall that they superimposed it with like a matte painting for the movie.
It shocks me that nobody's actually gone and made the mural.
That's a good point, actually, yeah, and no one's ever done that. You'd think this movie would be a little more celebrated where it was filmed.
Yeah, I mean, it's become such a beloved cult classic.
And one thing I always like to point out to people is that the little alley where the mural is in Venice Beach, this is a fun little LA piece of trivia. If you were to go right across the street from that, you'd find the street basketball courts from White Men Can't Jump.
I love that. There's another double feature for you.
Yes, your Venice Beach double feature. Maybe a triple feature with American History X. Throw a little darkness in there.
Oh, jeez. We're taking a turn now.
Well, I already killed Olivia Newton-John and made her a zombie, so
she was already dead. It's okay.
That's true. Okay, I only had a partial responsibility.
R.I.P. Poor one out. She is missed.
Dame Olivia. I really did like her as a kid. She seemed like such a cool person. Okay, so the Greek muses are on this wall. Sonny's littering hits them. They all come to life in this big splashy musical number called I'm Alive, which is literally like a minute and a half into the movie. So we're already getting this huge splashy musical number right off the bat.
We've been talking about this for like 45 minutes and we're a minute and a half into the movie. I just want to point that out. And you were worried. You were worried we didn't have enough material.
Yeah, you and I will be able to fill 90 minutes. The movie itself cannot. My notes are so meager on plot. Yeah.
Fair point. This is a very gif-able moment here. The Olivia Newton-John coming to life and looking around in wonderment it's excellently gif-able.
Oh yeah. All those muses are, if you actually pay attention to them, they all are. Mm-hmm. I was on the DVD commentary. The choreographer was saying all the muses, I made sure to make them. I wanted them very ethnically diverse. Everyone has a unique color. If you watch through the movie, the muses will show up in different costumes, but they always have one individual signature color they all have. And they said it was very important. I wanted to make them all have distinct, you know, personalities. So it's actually kind of cool if you watch this movie over and over, which I know is an odd thing to do, but pay attention to the muses. They're all dressed completely differently every time.
Yeah, it's very fun. And again, this just speaks to the visuals. I mean, there's a couple of scenes where they must have run out of, like, they ran out of muses because the visuals are terrible. But this is not one of those scenes. Like, this is just fun to watch.
Yeah, this is just a straight up great late 70s or early 80s movie moment with all these muses turning into colorful beams of light and flying across Los Angeles. And you see them going across all these little landmarks. And Olivia Newton-John has a little yellow outline around her. She roller skates around the boardwalk. It's just, again, it's just, this is just a fun, straight up fun scene, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it looks like they were enjoying themselves for sure.
Yeah, and this is one of my favorite songs in the movie. I'd maybe argue this might be my favorite song in the movie. I don't know. It's hard for me to pick, but I love I'm Alive. I will play a little clip of it right here in the podcast for you so you can hear what I'm talking about.
Lovely.
Yeah. But what's funny is there's another song later in the movie called It's a Lie, which sounds so much like I'm Alive that I'm amazed they're both in the same movie because it feels like they're the same song.
Yeah. I for a second, I thought it was like a reprise, like we're on Broadway or something.
Yeah. Okay. So all the muses have burst out of the wall because of Sunny's littering. Did you hear the subplot that they cut out of the movie that would have explained that a little more, why that happened?
No.
Well, when they originally wrote the script, Sunny had painted that mural on the wall. That was his mural.
Okay. So when, that makes sense.
Yeah, so when he throws his dreams away out the window, they go to one of his works of art that is so wonderful, and it makes it come alive. But they, in the many, many, many script rewrites they did over the years, they lost that subplot.
I mean, that makes sense, though. I think I almost, like, I know it's kind of there in the subtext.
Yeah, it's there. He mentions it earlier. He says, I'm painting murals that weren't mine or something like that. He kind of comments on it later.
Yep, he's a graffiti artist.
Yeah. But again, yeah, this I'm Alive scene.
He's Banksy.
He's Banksy. He was the original Banksy. He's the Venice Beach American Banksy.
Yes.
Okay, so yeah, so the muses have been born into Los Angeles, and I will leave this to you. Would you like to explain to people what a muse is, who if they may not know their Greek mythology?
Oh, well, Greek mythology, the muses were the daughters of Zeus. There were 9 of them, and each of them had a different discipline of the arts. And the legend has it that the muse would visit you, and you would be good at the art, and you would be inspired by her. And I think it's something that still carries over. I think it's an idiom that's very useful now.
Yeah, that's why this would make an excellent double feature with the Sharon Stone movie, The Muse.
I don't think that movie makes an excellent double feature with anything, but okay.
So wait, you're putting Xanadu with something as a double feature, and you're not saying that Xanadu is the weaker of the two?
No, I'm not.
Okay, just pointing that out. Okay.
Have you seen that movie?
I love The Muse, personally, but I love all Albert Brooks movies, so it's...
Yeah, I mean, Albert Brooks is great. And of course, you know, the least underrated movie of all time has Albert Brooks in it.
Let me say, the least underrated movie of all time. You're going to say Defending Your Life.
Hell yeah, I am.
Okay.
That movie's great.
Yeah. I love all Albert. My favorite Albert Brooks movie is Mother, but I love them all.
That's a good one too, yes.
Okay. All right. So the muses. Go back to the muses.
Go back to the muses. So I don't know how much we want to go into this. I don't have my copy of Dallaire's Greek Myths handy here, but yeah, there's music, there's history, there's comedy, there's drama, and there is dance, which I believe this is Kira is the character played by Olivia Newton-John, and she is actually Terpsichore, who is the muse of dance.
Is it Terpsichore? Is that how you pronounce it?
I think I didn't take Greek.
I don't know. I wrote down Terpsichore, but Terpsichore probably makes more sense.
Yeah, I don't know. Terpsichore. Somebody's going to yell at me. Somebody's like, you know, you don't speak Greek. Like, how dare you try to speak Greek? I'm not trying to speak Greek. I'm doing my best here. We're all just doing our best out here. But yeah, she and apparently she's a different muse in the Broadway musical. That was a piece of trivia I found that nobody cares about.
Yeah, that seems very not relevant to anything.
It is not relevant to anything. So yes, she is the muse of dance. And she then apparently photobombs a guy's album cover.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, I just wanted to clarify for people, this movie's strongly rooted in ancient Greek mythology. No, I'm just kidding. There's a little bit of Greek mythology with the muses, but there is kind of a Greek thing going through. So, yeah, she's a muse. She comes down, and the first thing she does is she turns into a roller skating Australian woman who roller skates down the boardwalk in Santa Monica, which is very pretty, by the way. This movie makes Santa Monica look really pretty. And as she's roller skating, she goes right by Jack Tripper on his way to the Regal Beagle, who was also filmed in Three's Company, also filmed right there in Santa Monica. But yeah, she crashes into Sonny Malone and she kisses him for some reason. And he's like, wow, a roller skating, glowing Australian woman just kissed me. And then she disappears. She goes flying away or whatever. And he's like, wow. So that's our introduction to Kira and Sonny.
Yeah, I don't really know what to say to this.
There's not really a traditional follow-up to that sentence.
There's really not. So Sonny goes to work. Sonny goes to work, and his job is to paint this album cover. And lo and behold, it's Kira on the album cover.
Yeah, what a coincidence. He's holding up this album cover. It's a painting of this. It's a cover of this old Art Deco auditorium, kind of a palladium in Los Angeles. There's a Olivia Newton-John on the front glowing in yellow. He's like, I just saw this woman on the beach. And he asks,
he's like totally made out with her.
Well, it's not so much they made out. She kissed him and then left. He didn't really get his licks in.
No, he really didn't.
Literally.
He will later.
Yeah, of course. In front of an old man. There, we'll talk about this later.
It's such a specific...
Gene Kelly, bless his heart. I can't believe he went out on this movie. Okay,
yeah.
We'll talk about
okay.
this.
All right, so he's... So Sonny just ditches work to go try to find this lady.
Yes. He's not a good employee. He leaves his job.
No, I would fire him too.
Exactly, to go find this piece of ass that just kissed him. He's like, who is this girl? So yeah, he goes looking around LA. It turns out there's a lot of beautiful girls. He can't find her specifically, but he does find one person, and that's an old man playing a clarinet. And this is our other main star of this movie.
Yes. Oh, he does. I want to mention, he does go and visit the photographer who took the album cover. And he's like, oh, I don't know. She didn't invoice her work. And I want to just put a public service announcement out there for all freelancers. Your work is important. You need to get paid. You need to invoice because it sets a bad example for other freelancers later. And someday people will think it's okay to not pay their freelancers because you didn't invoice. So always invoice your work.
This is where we insert that little NBC, the more you know, public service announcement.
Yeah. All right.
Important safety tip from Jessica here.
Yes. So we're going to Gene Kelly's beach clarinet now.
Yeah. So Gene Kelly, now I'll let you talk about this. Here's one of my great shames, and I'm debating if I should even mention this on Staff Picks because you're going to tear into me either way. I don't think I've ever seen Singing in the Rain all the way through.
Oh, my God.
So explain to people, as if I could not, perhaps why Singing in the Rain is important and why Gene Kelly was such a big deal.
Singing in the Rain is one of the best movies of all time, like objectively. And it is kind of a perfect piece of art. There is amazing music. There's beautiful dancing. The visuals are on point, and there is the dialogue and the writing is just like very, very snappy in this really satisfying way that's still very, very funny, you know, 70 years later. And, you know, I've watched that movie probably the number of times I've seen that movie is in the triple digits at this point. And it kind of winks at itself. It's very funny. And Gene Kelly is he's the star. He is the, and he, his dancing is what carries this movie. And, you know, An American in Paris is another great Gene Kelly movie, but, you know, he was a big deal. And one of the greatest dancers ever to grace the screen. But also, I think this is a good point to give a little background into Singing in the Rain, which is that was not a fun movie to make. This was a fun movie to make. Singing in the Rain, not a fun movie to make, because Gene Kelly would work people for like 20-hour days. And he didn't want to be cast opposite Debbie Reynolds. And so he was just a total dick to her the entire time. And she was, you know, she had several breakdowns. Like there was a point where she, during the making of the movie, she like ran off the stage and hid under a table. And Fred Astaire happened to be on the lot that day. And he came and like talked her back into going out and finishing the movie. And so his... notoriously hard to work with and very exacting when it comes to what he wants out of his dancing and out of the dancing of everybody that's dancing with him. And like really not a very nice guy at the end of the day. So this is why I said having to go out on the note of roller disco musical is maybe Gene Kelly's karmic retribution.
Well, thank you for all that history. That's exactly how I would have explained it had I chosen to give the Gene Kelly history.
I mean, I'm not an old Hollywood person, but I am a Singing in the Rain person.
Okay. Yeah, I know he's a huge legend. Now, had he been doing mini movies like in the 70s? I kind of get the sense this felt like a comeback role, like they kind of dragged this guy out of retirement. Was he doing stuff recently before this?
I mean, not really. I mean, he was not acting, but he wasn't... He wasn't doing the like circuit of like doing the guest slots on all of the 70s. Like he wasn't showing up on Fantasy Island, I don't think.
Okay. One thing I learned from watching the little DVD special today is that, you know, Gene Kelly wanted to be involved in this movie. His people like contacted the studio and they're like, yeah, there's this movie. It merges 40s music with 80s music. And it's all about modern dance and disco and roller skating. And it's all about movement. And Gene Kelly's like, yeah, I want to do it. And they're like, great. And then Gene Kelly dropped a little asterisk on them. He's like, I'll only do it under one condition. And they're like, what? And he says, I don't have to dance. And they're like, why would we want you in our dancing movie if you don't dance? And so it was like a huge back and forth to get him to go in this movie because he didn't want to dance. But so they eventually sold him over. And I think I read somewhere the only reason he eventually agreed was because they filmed it very close to his house. That's really what did it.
Yeah, the commute. I mean, who among us has not taken a good job for the commute? I think it is – okay, I looked him up on the – I've got him up on the IMDb, and he was working steadily up to the late 60s, and then he did like three movies in the 70s. So he did two movies in the 70s, and then he did Xanadu, and then he was on the Love Boat. So that's the trajectory. Like, that's the Xanadu trajectory.
He didn't really have that Xanadu burst of a second career that he thought he'd have.
No, he Xana didn't.
That was good. Okay, I should point out, though, is that we're going to make fun of Gene Kelly being in this movie, but on the DVD, they have a lot of interviews with his widow, and she always talks about how proud he was of this movie, that he really believed in this concept that you could merge different music styles. It's all about following your dreams. It's about art being inspired by muses. So he really did believe in the concept, and he worked very hard at it, and he was very proud of working with Olivia Newton-John and his work in it. And but she's like, but at the end of the day, he knew it didn't really work on the screen, but he was proud that he was a part of it.
Yeah, I mean, he seems like he's having a pretty good time. And I think it was probably kind of fun. Like, you're 68 years old, you get this job acting in this wacky musical. You don't have to necessarily take it too seriously, and you get to learn how to roller skate.
Oh, I should point out, his wife pointed out in the documentary, he was an excellent roller skater long before this movie. So she wanted to dispel that myth. Yeah, that because his childhood, he grew up on the East Coast, I forget, but she said he was a dancer, but also a very natural roller skater way before it was a thing.
Yep. Well, I now I picture him like out on the beach, out on Venice Beach with all the roller skaters.
Hopefully he wears a little more clothes than most of them do.
I mean, that's not how I'm picturing him.
Oh, great. So we've ruined the legacy of Ms. Newton-John and now of also Mr. Kelly. Thank you.
Look, you know what? If Xanadu didn't ruin the legacy for them.
Yes, you know, I was doing fine even with Xanadu, but then that Staff Picks podcast ruined us.
Oh, we're just ruiners. We're just a couple of ruiners.
Okay, so Gene Kelly is in this movie. He plays an old man named Danny McGuire who he's got a big, long, complicated backstory that I really couldn't give a shit about. But in the movie, he's like, he used to play with Glenn Miller, and he names all these old musicians that he played with in the 40s. He was a big, famous session musician, very famous clarinet player, used to be rich, but it's been, he used to own a music club, a speakeasy or whatever, back in New York in the 40s. So he's a big time old legendary musical figure who hasn't really had anything to live for a while. So he's kind of looking for his next dream.
Yeah. And he befriends this random dude on the beach and decides 15 minutes later to go into business with him.
Because that's really what Los Angeles is known for, is total strangers making business deals on the beach.
I mean, honestly, that's not inaccurate.
But I do love, again, the plot of this movie is so stupid the more you delve into it.
Yeah, I mean, the harder you interrogate this, like, the more upsetting it is. There's a great little interstitial scene here that brings to mind another one of the greatest movies of all time, which is Sonny is getting a ride home by hitching rides on the back of cars while he's on wheels, which reminds me of nothing more than the opening scenes of Back to the Future.
That's right. Xanadu leads to Back to the Future. It really does. I thought the same thing.
Yeah, it's an interesting through line there. I feel like Xanadu is important because without it, we don't get Back to the Future.
You know what else we don't get without Xanadu? And this is another thing I learned from the DVD today, is that this movie introduced a fashion trend that many people associate with the 80s, and it did not exist before Xanadu. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Which is?
Leg warmers.
I was going to say,
yeah.
Leg warmers.
They were the interviews with the choreographers and the fashion people on Xanadu, and they were very proud on the DVD that they introduced leg warmers to the world because it was just something they put on people for this musical. They thought it would look cool. They wanted Olivia Newton-John to have a gimmick, a shtick. So if you look, every scene she always has leg warmers or some variant of them. Even when in the animated scene, she has little leg warmers. They pointed that out.
Oh, yeah. I always associate her with leg warmers, but I thought it came later.
No, it came from this. They said this movie introduced leg warmers into the 80s, and they became a thing all because of Xanadu.
Wow. You know, cultural icon Xanadu.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have this old man, Danny McGuire, and his young protege, Sonny, for some reason deciding to go into business together. And the business will not become concrete until later, but it's going to be that Danny used to have a club back in the day. He wants to open a new musical club. Sonny wants to create something, a place that's like his vision that he doesn't have to compromise. And somehow their visions will work together to make this roller disco, which is not where I would go with that naturally, but that's where it's going to go. They're going to make a roller disco nightclub. That's kind of where we're going with this.
Yeah. I think we kind of have to, we have to give Kira credit for this, because I feel like Kira is the one who actually has the idea and she just sort of imparts it to them. And she's the one that's really into the roller disco at this point.
I don't know. I think that's a pretty hot take, saying that the muse is the person who inspired people.
Yeah, I know. I know. I'm spitting out scorchers tonight.
So the Greek muse is going to come down and inspire this roller disco park. And there's really not any more plot in this movie, to be honest. But okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, because for one thing, it's not Sonny's vision. He wants to be a painter. Like, just let the man paint. Why does he need to be a businessman? And one other thing, it's not Danny's vision either, because Danny wants to open up another jazz club.
Okay, let's talk about this, because I know you're dying to delve into this subplot.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, okay, I'll set
this
you up.
Is so upsetting.
I'll set you up. Jessica's raring to go here. She's going to spit some fire in this one. So there's a subplot in this movie that people may have forgotten about. I don't think people think about the plot of Xanadu as often as they should.
No.
Where the old man, Danny, back in the day, back when he was in like the World War II cadets and he played music, this old 1940s music, he had a girlfriend and she was his inspiration. She was his muse. Who would that of muse have been back in the 1940s?
It was Kira, because she's timeless. But yeah, here's a fun piece of trivia. I think we're going to get into this, but okay. We're in this scene. Like we're having his flashback where he's a young spry man playing the clarinet, and the man who's playing that clarinet in the flashback, like the guy that's playing young Gene Kelly, is a guy named Matt Latanzi. And this is maybe Olivia Newton-John's favorite part of this movie, because she ended up marrying that guy. And they were married for, I think, 15 years.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And the only reason that I clocked it was because their daughter showed up on one of those VH1 series in the mid-2000s about, like, it was all these children of rock stars trying to become rock stars. And their daughter, Chloe Latanzi, shows up on there, and she's Olivia Newton-John's daughter. And so her parents show up on the show as well. And, you know, it's a name that kind of sticks in your head. And so I was looking at the cast, I'm like, oh, wow, that guy's in there. And it turns out that's where they met.
Wow.
So, you know, it was a love connection for her, just not with the love connections that her character has. So, yeah, in the 40s, she was the muse of young Danny McGuire. And then she disappeared and left him heartbroken. And now she's back, and there's this chick that looks just like his girlfriend from the 40s, and she's hanging around all the time, and she's dating his business partner, and he's just supposed to be okay with that.
Not only that, she's making out with the young Sonny Malone in front of the old guy repeatedly.
Yeah, there's the one scene where he's like trying to do business, and they're just like standing off to the side, and they're slow dancing with no music playing.
Am I crazy, or did you used to be my girlfriend 40 years ago?
and occasionally she just sort of flirts with him, too. She's like keeping him on the hook in case something happens to Sonny.
Wow. So poor Gene Kelly in this movie. Yeah, what was the term you used in our email? That he's been cuckolded by Sonny?
He's been cuckolded, yes.
Oh, poor Gene Kelly. This is the movie he went out on, cuckolded by Gene.
By Olivia Newton-John and Michael Peck.
Yeah.
Yes.
And we even, we're embarrassed for poor Gene Kelly, and we're not even up to the all over the world sequence yet, which is his low moment in this movie.
Yeah, we're not there yet. But it's just crazy to me that this doesn't upset him at all. He's just like, oh, these crazy kids. I guess my days of being a sexual being are behind me.
Yes. I remember when I plowed that field.
Oh, my God.
Okay, I should point out, it's very specific in this movie that muses are not allowed to fall in love with humans. They're not allowed to interact. So there was no sex involved. So he's technically not cuckolded. But yeah, it's very rude of Kira to be making out with Michael Beck right in front of the old man she inspired 40 years ago.
Yeah, they can just...
So that's the way they do it in Australia.
I guess so.
Okay, so yeah, this is a very troubling subplot. Jessica seemed very concerned by it when we were talking earlier.
It just, I mean, this is not a movie that's supposed to be interrogated on this level, but the dynamic between the three of them. And then there's a point, and maybe I'm getting a little too ahead of myself, but there's a point where Gene Kelly is talking about the business arrangement they have and like about this great partnership he has with Sonny. And he's like, yeah, it's like being married, but not the good part. Yes. Like, you know what? If this is like if this becomes like a thruple movie, like a summer lovers situation, so it could have been way more interesting.
It's Bob and Ted and Carol and Alice and Kira.
Yeah. And Gene Kelly and roller skates.
Yeah, I wrote that in my notes too. I'm like, oh my God, did Gene Kelly just make a sex joke in a movie? I really didn't need to hear that.
Yeah, I thought sex didn't exist in Xanadu. Didn't we just establish that?
It's a place where nobody dares to go, but nobody dares to come either. That's right, I was saving that one for you.
Wow.
Alright, so now that we've completely ruined the purity and innocence of Xanadu, let's get back to the movie.
Yes.
So Sonny one day, he's grabbing a skate behind a truck, as people often used to do in movies, and he ends up at this palladium or auditorium. I forget the name of it. Actually, let me look at my notes. I have it. This was a real building in L.A. This was the Pan Pacific Building, which is a very iconic Art Deco building in Los Angeles that was a really cool movie location. It's very distinct. If you see it in the movie, you'd recognize it. And sadly, it burned down in, I think, 1989. So it does not exist anymore. Yeah, I would have loved to see it. Yeah, it's really cool. Yeah.
There's a point where they say, oh, they used to have wrestling here. And it turns out they really did used to have wrestling there.
That's right. The movie strives for historical accuracy.
I like it when they get stuff right.
They do. So he goes in and he sees this. This has been earlier in the movie. He was painting an album that he's a record that had this building on the front with Olivia Newton-John in front of it. And he recognizes the building. He's like, I'll go in here. And this is where he discovers that this is where Kira lives when she's not up on Mount Olympus.
Yeah, she lives in this derelict building.
So she's a squatter.
With the rats.
Yeah, she's a squatter.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She's squatting before it was cool. Yes.
She's invoked squatter's rights, and she's in here. And what she does in her spare time is she just basically skates around in a circle to the sounds of Olivia Newton-John's number one hit song, Magic, in the background.
Yeah, that song's a banger.
I love that song. That
it's wonderful.
One of my very favorite songs of all time. It's such a big hit. And that's, again, like you said, the music saves this movie. This is such a stupid movie, but man, there's some good songs in here.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And so, yeah, then they have like their little pairs skating moment. A lot of shots from the waist up.
Okay, so let me describe this movie. This is one of the only few plot-heavy scenes in the movie where he meets Kira for the first time, and he's like, you! And she's like, me! And he's like, why do we keep meeting? And she's like, sounds like somebody is setting us up. And so he's like, who are you? Why do you skate in here? And then he's like, can I know more about you? Who are you, mystery woman? He turns into Garth. I love you, dream woman! But yeah, and she's like, well, I can't tell you anything, but we'll see each other soon, Sonny. Bye. And then she skates away. But I think the only thing he learns here is that her name is Kira.
Yeah, and she knows his name for some reason.
Okay.
Yes.
So yeah, so basically the rest of the movie is him trying to chase down Kira, trying to figure out who she is. And God, I should look at my notes and follow the plot, but I can't because the plot is just, it makes no sense. What happens?
What happens is they start fixing it up, except that both Sonny and Danny hate this building. this majestic Art Deco masterpiece. They show up and they're like, yeah, this is hideous. This sucks. Why would we ever want this? And then, you know, Kira convinces them that it's got good bones. And so then they have a big fight about, oh no, we got to back up and talk about the weirdest fucking recording studio of all time.
Okay. Yeah. We're skipping some music moments. Okay. So we'll talk about the recording. Okay. Well, first I want to talk about, there's at least two musical numbers here. They're going to pop up in the middle of this movie. One of them is where Gene Kelly is at his house reminiscing about his dream girl back from the 40s, Kira. And he ends up, they end up having this ballroom dance segment together with Gene Kelly and Olivia Newton-John.
Yep. And it's beautiful. And the song is beautiful. And the dancing is lovely. I wanted them to make out at the end of it, and they didn't.
No way. No way they're giving Gene Kelly that. That's only Sonny gets to touch her.
Yeah, that's not fair.
Okay, a little trivia about this scene. So yeah, there's a really famous dance number in this movie where Olivia Newton-John and Gene Kelly dance together. And one of the trivia things about that is that I learned from the DVD is they had finished this movie and they wrapped it all up. And test audiences were like, well, you know what? There's no scene where Gene Kelly dances with Olivia Newton-John. And the producers were like, oh, yeah, shit. I guess we probably should have done that. They seemed like they were big stars. So they had to go try to get them. The movie was wrapped and their contracts were up. And they're like, Gene, would you come back and work for us? He's like, fuck no. My contract's done. Screw you. I don't dance. And they're like, well, we need something with you and Olivia Newton-John. Could you choreograph it? And so almost out of the goodness out of his own heart, he agreed to come back. And he said, I'll do it under one condition. I get to choreograph this dance. It's going to be very old school like my old ones. It'll be a closed set. No one's on there but me, like the photographer and Olivia, and I have complete control and I get to do it all. So it's actually
That's Gene Kelly.
Yeah, but it's actually a very sweet scene. I know Olivia Newton-John talked very highly later of how much she loved working with him and how much admiration they had for each other in this scene.
Yeah, I mean, it is a beautiful scene. I've heard that the choreography is very similar to choreography that he did for a movie in the 40s. So it's not, it does kind of smack of, oh, we forgot to do this thing. You should probably come do it. And he's got like 30 minutes to come up with something. But it is quite lovely. And they have good chemistry. They dance well together.
I was going to say, to me, this is one of the least memorable scenes of the movie, but it's very beautiful. And mm-hmm. I think for fans of Gene Kelly and people who watch this movie for Gene Kelly, that would have been the standout scene of the movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that might be the thing that made me want to watch the movie in the first place.
So not the roller disco and the flashing beams of light?
I mean, I came for Gene Kelly and I stayed for the flashing disco roller beam lights.
Yeah, that really should have been the tagline for the movie right there.
I'm good at taglines. What can I say?
Okay, so now we talk about the recording studio that you mentioned. So there's another really iconic scene in this movie where Olivia Newton-John and Michael Beck slow dance to the move, the song Suddenly, which is a duet that Cliff Richard did with Olivia Newton-John. Very beautiful scene. I really love this scene. And it's really actually kind of impressive that they're slow dancing on roller skates, but explain the studio that they're in. Cause yeah, this is a bizarre scene.
Yeah. He's like, this is where the musicians go to get inspired. And it's like all of these big practical effects in this giant airplane hangar. And there's like for some reason there's an entire train. I want to consider this scene itself a shout out to Singing in the Rain, because there is a scene in Singing in the Rain where they go onto a soundstage and Gene Kelly like turns on all these practical effects and sings to Debbie Reynolds, and they have this very sweet moment, and Debbie Reynolds probably walked off the set and cried. But it is sort of kind of the same beat where it's like, I'm going to show you this magical place where, you know, the artistry is alive here, and it's an allegory for how much you inspire me. But it's like, he's not supposed to be in there because he works in the art garage, not in the practical effects studio. And he gets busted and gets fired for it, which he very much should have. He's like messing with all their stuff. Like, how much does that stuff cost to set up? And he's just like triggering all of these different effects. And like, I'm firmly on team Mr. Simpson here.
It's basically he's on the Universal Studios tour. That's what that hangar looks like.
Yep, and Jaws jumps out, and then Norman Bates chases you. And
one of my favorite little moments, and I don't know if this is intentionally funny or unintentionally funny, how the whole movie is about how she inspires Sunny and she gets him to do things. But there's a very interesting moment in this sequence when they're dancing around the studio where they go by some palm trees and the palm trees rise up very phallically as they're dancing.
Yes.
Which, was that intentional? Does that what she's inspiring?
I'm sure it is. I think it's the same as like the end of North by Northwest when they show the train going into the tunnel.
Yes. Anyway. But yeah, this is one of my favorite scenes in the movie. I love the Suddenly duet. I love the song. I love the choreography. In fact, I was just commenting to my wife as she was not paying attention to this movie whatsoever. I'm like, you know, it's really impressive in this scene that Olivia Newton-John, it looks like she's doing her own skating and her own dancing. She's doing her own stunts. Like, I can't see any moment where they pull away and it's a stunt double. And then I looked up the trivia on this scene and it says, Olivia Newton-John injured her coccyx in this scene when she fell.
Yeah. I mean, that's easy to do on roller skates.
Yeah. And that makes sense for someone who's probably not a professional roller skater trying to do a dance number on ramps in a movie.
Yeah. Yeah, she's not coming off of Starlight Express here.
But again, very beautiful scene. There's so, as much as I want to take digs at this movie, there's like five or six legitimately just some of the most beautiful things I've ever seen in the movie, and this is one of them.
Yeah. And Suddenly is a great song, but it really feels to me it's like ELO trying to do the Bee Gees.
Yes.
Like, there's all these Bee Gees harmonies in it, and it's like, now I just want to go listen to the Bee Gees.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, Suddenly is a fantastic song, but it speaks to how strong the soundtrack is when it's like the 10th best song on the soundtrack.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so we have another musical number here coming up. And again, there's only like, four, like Jessica said, like 30% plot, 70% music in this movie. So there's a really interesting duet or montage here called Dancin', which on the DVD, on the choreographer, all the choreographers and the, you know, the dancers were very proud of this scene. This is one of their proudest scenes. And I'll set the stage and I'll let you loose, Jessica.
But, okay.
So what they're trying to do is they're trying to put a vision in Danny and Sonny's head of what the Xanadu place could look like. Danny, the old man, wants it to look like an old 1940s big band type, you know, music hall. Sonny, the young guy, wants it to look like a modern day sexy rock and roll palace where, you know, it's very 80s and hip. And so what they do in this scene is they'll have two competing visions of what Xanadu can look like. One's a 40s big band number. One's a modern day 80s rock number. And as these two groups are singing their songs and doing their shtick, the two sets will eventually merge with each other and they become one cohesive song, which, again, from a music standpoint, is really ambitious and really cool they're able to do that. But God, this is a fucking goofy scene.
God, it's 95 minutes long, for starters. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those moments where it's like, where were the production designers that made all the beautiful stuff before it? Because these costumes are bad. Like, there's one of the women in the 40s montage has the worst wig on, and it's like half off her head. And I couldn't watch anything else except this wig. And it was really upsetting. I don't want to go to either one of these clubs. And I mean, I do enjoy, like, the rock band that's up there is the Tubes, who are a very famous 80s new wave band who had a couple of minor hits. And they're a great band. It's cool to see them in here. They deserved better. I think it's one of those things where it's like, if you don't have the benefit of being in 2024 and looking at all the music that came after it, I think it's very interesting because, you know, we've had years and years now of mashups, and this is essentially a mashup. And I love that about it, but it's also like, this was done better in the Trolls World Tour genre battle.
Wow. High praise.
Yeah, it's such a cool idea, and it's so badly executed. I'm glad that they're proud of it. I'm glad they enjoyed making it. I don't really enjoy watching it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with it. This is the part of the scene that, like, I want to fast forward this part of the movie. When I get to it, it's just kind of boring because I want to get to the Xanadu stuff at the end.
Yeah.
But like, I'm this is like a train wreck. This scene in particular, I'm fascinated by watching it because it's like so ambitious, and they really are kind of pulling it off, but it's also not interesting.
You know what it is, though? I think this is another Gene Kelly shout out, because this is a thing about Singing in the Rain that I think the older I get, the more I like it. When I was a kid, I hated this part, but the last, And American in Paris does the same thing. But the last, like, 15 minutes of Singin' in the Rain are all of a sudden, like, all the dialogue, all the musical numbers drop out, and the entire thing is told in dance. And it's sort of like a story within a story. And this, to me, felt very much like that. And I think the number at the end also feels very much like that, where they just stop telling the story one way, and they pivot to telling it through motion and dance. And I think if you view it as a tribute to what Gene Kelly liked to do in those 40s and 50s movie musicals, then it's a little bit more tolerable, but it's also like not well executed.
Yeah, I was going to say they really steer into in this movie trying to be all things for all people. They want to draw in people of all that like all styles of music. I mean, that's kind of the, not to get too deep into this movie, but it's whole, the plot of the movie is it inspires art and what do you like and how art is different for everyone else and just find the thing that's personal to you. So they really go for that. And in a sense, you kind of need this scene in the movie because the whole point of the movie is the visions of two very different people trying to merge into one.
Yeah.
So I see the point of this movie. They're trying to do that, but yeah, it's just, it's not that interesting to watch. And it's,
yeah,
like you said, they just drop the plot for a while because they're so impressed with what they're pulling off musically that the movie just kind of stops dead for, like you said, a good 95 minutes.
Yeah. And not to mention, we are talking about the competing visions of a guy who's trying to do something that he already did much better 30 years before.
Mm-hmm.
And a guy who has no experience with any of this stuff and just wants to paint.
So they're competing for Kira's vision, basically.
Basically, yes.
Yeah. Okay, I got to talk about one thing about the scene is that back on I Love the 80s, and I go on rants about this all the time. My wife laughs how much this bothers me. Is that back on I Love the 80s, the most iconic part of the Xanadu segment is where Hal Sparks talks about the scene. And he's like, remember that scene in Xanadu inside the auditorium where there's the good band and the evil band? And they're like competing to see whose music is going to win. And Hal Sparks is like, I always thought it was weird because I kind of like the evil band. And that pisses me off. And I don't know why it pisses me off so much that Hal Sparks completely misinterprets the scene. There's no good band. There's no evil band. It's 40s versus 80s style. There's no good and evil. Hal Sparks, you made a bad value judgment. And I really hate that it was documented and chronicled in I Live the 80s Forever. And that's people's vision of Van of Xanadu. Because that just completely misses the point of this stupid scene.
Yeah. Yeah. It's morally neutral.
Yes. But yeah, okay. If Hal Sparks were to say, you know what? I kind of like the modern music better. You know what? He's right. I agree with you. The modern music was way better, even though it was dumb and goofy 80s rock or late 70s rock.
Yeah, I mean, it's dumb and goofy. I feel like this is one of those ones where it's like, if I got this movie on while I'm doing laundry, I can like focus on my folding. I don't have to watch it. I can just listen to it.
I mean, that's most of the movie in general, right?
I mean, yeah, I did do laundry while I watched this movie.
Yes, it's an excellent movie to do laundry to.
Yes.
I should point out one trivia fact I learned from this about this movie is that the Tubes were interviewed on the DVD. And they're like, you know how many people ask us to play that song, I Won't Take a Backseat? They're like, every time we go anywhere, that's the number one song people want to hear. They just want to hear us. They want to see us in those dumb electric orange jumpsuits, and they want to hear that song. And the interviewer is like, do you play it? And he's like, no, never. We will never play that song ever.
Well, you know, orange jumpsuits right now are having a moment. Because we've just come off of the Super Bowl and the Dunkin' Donuts commercial with Ben Affleck in a big orange tracksuit. I feel like it's kind of the intellectual heir to these jumpsuits they're wearing in this movie.
You know what my favorite thing is on Staff Picks is when people date the podcast and when they say what happened in the news the week before and then the episode is released 2 years later.
I know, this episode's coming out in like 2035.
Yeah, Jessica's now forced me to edit this, so this will be my next episode. So that was very crafty of you. Well done.
I'm not forcing you to do anything. I like that we have a time capsule.
Okay, so Sonny and Danny have agreed to turn this palladium into this roller disco to impress Kira, basically. They're doing it for a girl. They had to go see about a girl. And this is where we learn what the name of the place. They're trying to think, what should we call our new roller disco? And Kira, of course, appears and she quotes the Coleridge poem. Are you know the poem, right?
In Xanadu did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure dome decree. Or out the sacred river ran and caverns measureless to man down to the sunless sea?
Yeah, so you do know it. Okay, yeah.
I do know it.
Yeah. So she suggests you name this place Xanadu, which is again, look up the history of Xanadu. It's an interesting history. But yeah, so she suggests the name, and then Danny's like, oh yeah, what a wonderful name. And he's like, hey, don't I know you? This is like the first time the movie's like, you're that girl I used to bang back in the 40s. And she's like, no, I've never seen you before. Anyway, just wanted to point
that
out.
And then like, when Sonny's back is turned, she kind of mouths at him, yeah, I was that girl.
Yeah. I'm way older than you think, Sonny. This is now Harold and Maude. You had no idea. Okay, so yeah, so Sonny and Kira, let's see, as Sonny and Danny are building their new roller disco derby, whatever, Sonny and Kira continue to date, and we see them walking around LA and going on dates, and they have lots of little meet cutes, and it's very cute. And this is where we get a scene that a lot of people say has no business being in this movie. It doesn't fit the movie, the animated sequence.
Ah, yes. Well, this was like they needed something extra to go in there, so they had the animated sequence put in after the fact.
Okay, yeah, to explain this to people. So they had an extra song in the movie. Was it Don't Walk Away? I think that's the name. It's an ELO song. And they needed to contractually put it in the movie, but they couldn't figure out a way to do it. So they're like, you know what? Fuck it. Just there's a scene where Danny or Sonny and Kira are on a date. Let's just turn them into cartoon characters and hire Don Bluth, who was a Disney animator at the time, very famous Disney animator, and we'll just have him write an animation sequence. And there was an interview with Don Bluth on the DVD. He's like, I didn't really know what they wanted. And they're like, just make them do romance and shit. So he did. He writes a scene. He wrote this whole scene with them, you know, these two little cartoon figures kissing and turning into different animals. Like they're a fish, they're a bird at one point. And it's a very cute little scene, but it really drags the movie to a halt.
Yeah, it's the Don Bluthiest Don Bluth thing that ever Don Bluthed.
Absolutely.
But also, this is a trope that I really love because, like, I would say possibly my favorite Disney musical also does this, which is Bedknobs and Broomsticks. There is a scene where all of a sudden there are cartoons for no reason. And same thing, Mary Poppins does it too.
That's a good point. It does, yeah.
Yeah, I love it. I feel like more movies need to have a cartoon break.
Well, it's interesting because Don Bluth had said that when he would see this in the theater and he was kind of embarrassed. He's like, it wasn't my best work. I rushed it. But he said that whenever this scene would pop up in the theater, afterwards the audience would always applaud. So he was very proud. So apparently this scene plays very well in theaters.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I had seen this as a child, this would be my favorite sequence.
Okay. And again, in a soundtrack full of bangers, this is Don't Walk Away, which is a really pretty song, but still like the ninth best song on the soundtrack. A gathering to meet me when you're gone.
Yeah, I don't know. I would probably we previously said that we thought Suddenly was the 10th best song on the soundtrack. I don't know. I would rank Suddenly above this.
Oh yeah, there was no scientific research behind my ranking. I just pulled that out of my butt.
Yeah, I'm trying to maintain a canon here.
It's very important to have a canon when it comes to Xanadu.
Well, look, when the staff picks Wiki drops, I want to make sure that people have consistent sources. Yes.
Well, okay, Don Bluth, I have to point out, very famous Disney animator. He did he do Cinderella?
Black Cauldron.
Black Cauldron, lots of stuff. I know him personally from the 80s, from video games, from Dragon's Lair.
Of course.
Yeah, and so if anybody's an 80s nerd, watch this sequence and watch how similar Kira looks to Princess Daphne. It's almost the exact same animation.
Yeah, and he very famously left Disney on bad terms and opened up his own studio and did a lot of stuff in the 80s, like American Tail and Land Before Time. And so he is like, he's all over everything, but he has very specific tropes that once you see a lot of animation, you can spot his stuff a mile off.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. We are basically to the end of the movie, which I know is hilarious because there's been no plot, but we almost,
well, and also, we're near the end of the movie, but there's like 20 minutes left in the movie.
Correct. There's like 20 minutes because there's like seven songs all in a row, and they're all pretty good. And we're about to come to one of the most signature moments in Xanadu, the All Over the World song.
Yes.
So let me set this up, and again, I'll let you loose on this one. So Danny and Sonny are a day away from opening their new modern-day roller disco, and Danny's like, oh, it's going to be great on opening day. I'll wear my tux. And Kira and Sonny, the hip young people, are like, you can't wear a tux. This is a hip modern club. You need hip modern clothes. So Gene Kelly's like, huh, where should we go? And they actually have a phrase. What do they say? I swear to God, there's a phrase. She says, we have to go to a franchise glitz dealer. Which is apparently a place in this, the late 70s. I don't know. But Kira's like, we need to get you with something with a little more pizzazz. So they're going to take fucking old man Gene Kelly to the hippest 1970s fashion palace and get him some hip new threads, which, God, this scene must have been embarrassing for Gene Kelly.
It's so fun, though. Well, and okay, for starters, here's another moment that's really awkward where Kira's like, hey, I'm not going to dance with you unless you look hot. Okay. Telling Gene Kelly that you won't dance with him unless he looks hot. That's a whole mood. It's like also, like, stop stringing this guy along. You're dating his business partner.
Yes. If you were younger and cuter, maybe. Instead, let me go make out with Sonny.
Yeah, in front of you. Yeah, but I love, like, this is Gene Kelly. He's actually dancing, which is great. He said he wasn't gonna, and then he does anyway because he can't help it.
Let me say something, and I say this with the highest possible respect, and I'm not, this is the Jerry Seinfeld, not that there's anything wrong with that. This might be the gayest sequence ever put into a movie. It's really close.
Might be top 10, but I don't know, I love it. It's beautiful.
Oh, I agree with you, I love it, but this is the scene when my kids catch me watching this movie. This is the one they give me the little stink eye that I'm enjoying this scene a little too much. Like, Dad, there's no way you could be straight and be enjoying this scene that much.
I want to start a band called Franchise Glitz Dealer, for starters.
I don't know. It seemed like it might have been a trademarked phrase back in the 70s that might still be hanging around.
I don't know. I Googled it, and all I found was Xanadu references.
Okay, well, I'm going to put you on the spot here. This is maybe the hardest job anybody has ever asked anybody to do on a podcast. Explain the all-over-the-world montage to people.
No.
How
I can't.
Do not tell me it's no.
It's not possible. It's 20 minutes longer than it should be. We'll start there. Gene Kelly is on roller skates, and you don't really get a sense, apparently, of how well he's skating. And then it's just...
Would you like me to step in? I actually have some notes on this.
Please, please, please do.
Okay, I would enjoy painting this picture of you since I love this scene. My kids, I'd like my kids to know I love this scene so much that they go to this really fancy late 70s disco fashion store. And when they get there, all the mannequins turn to life and start dancing to the song All Over the World. Yes. Gene Kelly starts imitating them, doing his little dance. And then they go inside and they are dressed by leather boys. And women in spiderweb stockings and shirtless dudes with glitter paint on their lips. And Gene Kelly is put into various green and pink, gaudy, late 70s disco, you know, polyester outfits. And he must dance for people to show off what his new duds look like. And it's a fever dream. That's all I'll say. This whole scene is just a big fever dream.
But the colors are so great. Like it's very 70s. I feel like the sort of jewel tones of this whole thing.
Oh yeah. 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 And like I said, on the DVD, the fashion people, the costumers were so happy with this scene. They're like, that is every cool hip fashion in 1979 in one scene. They're like, every single thing we did in this scene was cutting edge, was, you know, hip, would have been seen as cool. So they are so proud of the fashions in this scene, even though it looks ridiculous now.
Oh yeah. And there's the one guy that's got the, like, the hair that sticks out everywhere. It looks like some Sideshow Bob business.
Mm-hmm. And again, lots of shirtless dudes. Got to point that out. Lots of them.
Yep. Yep. Lots of shirtlessness. Lots of like, I just, this is also, I feel like there's some Singing in the Rain elements to this as well. Like they, like Gene Kelly showing up in outfit after outfit and then doing like a different little dancing riff on each outfit.
Yeah, you know, that's probably true. That there probably was an intentional, we'll just do Singing in the Rain, just a modern, cool version of. That's probably what they're thinking at the time.
I think it's exactly what they're thinking, because there is even, there's a number in Singing in the Rain that's like, he's performing like a, and I don't even think it's him, actually. It's like these dancing girls, and every month of the year they have different outfits on. And that's what it reminds me of. But yeah, then he's got fringe on and he is roller skating, and he's the only one on roller skates at this point, which is also weird.
Yeah, I was going to say, does the Singing in the Rain scene feature Gene Kelly in pink fringe cowboy outfit with a pimp hat and roller skates?
He wears some ridiculous stuff in that movie.
Okay.
Nothing that ridiculous, but...
Yeah, once you've encountered all over the world, there's no turning back. Now you're invested in Xanadu. You're not turning back at this point. Xanadu is full steam ahead until the end.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I feel like there's two kinds of people in the world. There's people that get this and people that don't. Maybe three kinds of people, because there's people that get this and people that don't, and people that don't but like it anyway.
Exactly. Yeah, I like this scene. It's goofy. But again, it's very of its era. This is what movies were in late 1979. This is what these musicals were like. I just love that this is one of the most 1979 examples of this trope.
Yeah, I feel like there's some kind of Zodiac element to this. Like, I feel like me being born around this time informs my personality.
Wow. That's very impressive. Okay, so all over the world has happened. Gene Kelly has got his hip new clothes for the opening of Xanadu. But surprisingly, there's a third act in this movie where the plot has to take one last twist. Right before the opening of Xanadu, everyone's dreams coming true, Kira has to break up with Sonny and dump him.
Yep. I mean, she was here for a good time, not a long time.
Yes, as muses often do.
Yep, and then she's like, yeah, sorry, my dad says we can't date anymore.
Sorry, my dad Zeus, he's kind of a dick sometimes. Maybe you've read mythology.
Have you heard of him? Yeah, we got to dump you so he doesn't hit you with a thunderbolt.
Yes. So the rule is Kira cannot fall in love when she's on Earth. She's a muse. She is the daughter of Zeus. And we're meant to think Zeus's wife Hera is Kira's mother, but it's actually not Hera. I looked it up. It's what?
It's Nemnos. It's Nemesine?
Yeah, Nemesine. Yeah. Nemesine. But yeah. So Kira is called back to heaven the night before, or Kira is called back to Mount Olympus the night before the opening of Xanadu, and Sonny is heartbroken. He's like, I can't open this place without you. And she's like, well, I was a muse. I was here to inspire you, and you were inspired, and now I got to go to someone else's dream. So she goes back up to Mount Olympus. And this is where we get an exceptionally goofy scene where Sonny has to chase her to Mount Olympus to win her back.
Now, if I'm Kira and my job is to just go inspire people and I feel bad that they fall in love with me, maybe the play here is to like inspire straight women and gay men.
That does seem like it would be less problematic for her.
Yeah, I wouldn't get as emotionally invested, and like maybe you don't get the good art that way, but I wouldn't be breaking hearts all the time. And also, like, why wasn't she more bothered by, like, why is this the one that she's so bothered by? Because she's like right in front of her ex making out with a dude all the time. Yeah. And it doesn't bother her.
Yeah, she seems very upset that she broke the rules, although it would seem very easy for her to break the rules.
It kind of seems like she does all the time.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, so she dumps Sonny, so she goes back up to Mount Olympus, and this is where, this is the It's a Lie scene, and again, it's a very similar scene. We had I'm Alive, and I'm not going to even bother trying to sing it, but it's the exact same melody, It's a Lie, and I swear I saw this movie like five times before I realized those were two different songs.
Yeah, well, also, this song sounds like they took every other song on the soundtrack and put it in a blender. Like it's like the mathematical mean of all of the other songs on the soundtrack.
I should point out there's actually something kind of artsy-fartsy about this scene that I didn't really catch until recently. But I do agree with you. This is one of the weaker songs. It's like ELO's greatest hits. They just chop it all up and put it into one song. But when they do I'm Alive at the start, it's with the muses coming out of the mural. And so now we play another song that is basically the exact same song, just a little bit different. But now it's going to be someone going into the mural. So there might be a little artsy-fartsiness here of why they're so similar songs.
Yeah, I think that's intentional. It's a lie.
Anyway, yeah, so Sonny goes back to the boardwalk. He has to get Kira because she needs to be there for opening day. He's in love with her. And he finds the mural on the wall that they all came out of at the start. And if you look really closely, this is where you can tell that it's just superimposed on the wall. It looks really crappy the second time you see that mural. It looks like a children's watercolor.
Yeah, it's gotten, like, it's degraded somehow. Like, maybe it's like the muses came off of it and, like, what's left is, like, all the paint and crap that they didn't take with them.
Is it like Twins? That's the leftover of the milkshake, the Danny DeVito part?
Yep, that's the Danny DeVito, yes.
So Michael Beck roller skates around LA and finds that mural, and he decides he's going to go into it because he's going to go grab Kira from the afterworld and pull her back. And surprisingly, it works. This actually works out pretty well.
Yeah, it's a good thing that it worked, because otherwise he would have just like gone 20 miles an hour into that wall.
Yes. The movie's now called Suicide, not Xanadu. You face first
into
the
wall. Suicide. Suicide.
Where nobody dares to go. See, now we're getting dark again. Thank you.
Oh, God. This movie is sweetness and light, and we're just making it so dark and bad.
This is why I like having Jessica on the podcast, because I know we can get away with anything here.
Oh, we're ruining it for everybody.
I'm sorry if we're ruining Xanadu for people. It's terrible. It will haunt me. Okay, so he goes up to the heavens and he sees Kira, and it's this weird laser light show. I don't even know what they're doing at this point.
This is the one where she's just standing there doing nothing.
It's like she's in a bowling alley.
Yeah, like I've seen karaoke performances that were more dynamic than this.
Oh, this is the one you're talking about. Okay, so
yeah.
Okay, so to sum it up, so he goes there, he says, Zeus, I'm in love with your daughter. She's like, Sonny, you have to get out of here, in her Greek/Australian accent. And Zeus is like, nobody has come up here and tried to take one of my daughters away. And he's like, well, I'm in love with her. I need her. And Zeus is like, no. And he like basically sends him back to Earth. So it doesn't work. But this is where Kira, Olivia, gets her big solo moment in the movie. This is the only time, I think, where she just is on stage all by herself just singing. She sings, what is the song? I wrote it down on my notes. What's the name of the song?
I didn't write it down because it made me so unhappy.
Okay, it's called Keep Me Suspended in Time with You, something like that.
Yeah, and she's suspended. That makes sense because she's suspended in time while she's performing the song.
Yeah, she literally doesn't move. I think they paralyze her or something.
Yeah,
It's a beautiful song, but yeah, the choreography leaves something to be desired, although...
Maybe it was like she couldn't move around too much while she's in Tron.
Yes, the light cycles are going to take her out if she moves too far.
Yeah. It's harder to animate the like laser light show behind her. Yes.
But it is a beautiful scene, and this is where Kira sings her song to Zeus, her father, please let me go down and bang this guy, basically.
Yeah.
But it's a pretty song, and of course Olivia Newton-John at her peak. Really, people have argued this is her peak cuteness, these are her peak songs. You could argue that's probably all true. She's really adorable.
Yeah, they thought she could get away with standing still for 3 solid minutes because she was that cute and she almost pulls it off.
She kind of does, I have to say. And I can think of few performers who could have done that. But
I get a feeling when I'm with you.
Yeah, I mean, original working title of the song was "Please Let Me Go Down and Bang This Guy."
It was, yeah. They had to change it.
I mean, it scans to keep me suspended in time with you.
Yes. Okay, but yeah, I was gonna say, how many performers could get away with just standing there and not moving and singing? Like, I couldn't picture Miley Cyrus like pulling off the song.
No, but I would watch the remake of Xanadu with Miley Cyrus in it.
That would be. Can I go down and bang that guy, y'all? That'd be pretty cool.
Just come in like a wrecking ball.
Kira's entrance is much different. She's naked on a wrecking ball. Okay, so
all right.
So, yeah, let's wrap this movie up. So
let's go to the club.
Yeah, so Kira sings the song, and Zeus is like, "Well, all right, maybe I'll let you go down to Earth and have sex with that mortal." And the wife, and the wife's like, his wife is like, which again, I should point out that Zeus is not known for being in a particularly close marriage ever, but in this, his wife seems very close with him. She's like, "Oh yes, let's let our daughter go down into Earth and for at least for one night." And Zeus is like, "One night or for eternity, whatever."
Yeah, and it's like, Zeus, you're such a hypocrite, because, like, all you ever do is go down to Earth and, like, turn mortal women into stuff so you can bang them.
Yeah, I know. All of a sudden, he has a problem with this. No, I don't think it's distasteful for the gods to be having sex with mortals.
Yeah, well, I'm the only one who's allowed to do that.
We can't have sex with mortals, because you already had sex with all of them, Zeus.
Yeah, you don't want to share anything with your dad.
Very awkward family relationship. Okay,
let's
down to Xanadu. So now the rest of the movie is the opening of the club. And oh boy, do we have a showstopper for you. The opening night of Xanadu, which starts with these letters on the wall that light up from black to red, X-A-N-A-D-U. Gene Kelly in a tux. I guess he got rid of his new hip duds. Now he's back in a tux again.
Yeah, they said it was okay after all. They're like, "You know what? We did that whole number. And you were right. It should be a tux."
Yeah. "Sorry we humiliated you. Yeah, you were
or
right."
Or maybe it's like he thought maybe Kira wasn't going to dance with him anyway, so it didn't matter.
That's true. Yeah. So, okay. I wrote down in my notes here all the things in the opening of Xanadu. So Xanadu opens the club. We have Gene Kelly on roller skates in a tux. We have jugglers. We have disco. We have dancers. We have about 20 different costumed people, well, I mean, different costumes, groups of costumes around the place. We have tightrope walkers. We have guys in zoot suits.
We have a guy doing splits on a tightrope.
Exactly. We have acrobats. I mean, this is literally like Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club. This is like Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite. This is like, yeah. Way too weird, this whole club.
Yeah. Also, it has about as much bright red deep pile carpeting as Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which that was a whole thing in the 70s, and it's really upsetting.
Ooh, do you want to hear some fun 70s trivia about this set, the set they filmed on? So in the middle of the Xanadu set, everyone is going to be roller skating around. It's like a, I remember on I Love the 80s, Mo Rocca described it as, Gene Kelly is a Pied Piper on roller skates leading people to their death.
Yeah,
but they're
accurate.
All, yeah, they're all going around a circle. There's this big circle in the middle of a circular stage. That, for 70s sci-fi nerds, is the same set they used in the movie Logan's Run. That's the carousel where people spin until they go up to their deaths or whatever.
My God.
Yeah, they reused the set for Xanadu. So Logan's Run and Xanadu have something in common.
Yeah, you know, it's a good thing that Gene Kelly wasn't in Logan's Run.
He would have been dead like 40 years ago.
Yeah. He would have died right after the musical number.
Which you could argue he almost did in this movie.
He almost did. Like, I think, what a way to go. What a way for this to be your last movie.
You know, how do you top that? You can't top. Exactly. I guess you said The Love Boat. That's how he tried.
Yeah, The Love Boat. He did like two other things, but I think it's funny to go straight from this to The Love Boat.
It's too bad Tarantino couldn't resurrect his career somehow.
Yeah, that's a collab I would have liked to see. But I think Gene Kelly, I think he died in 94 or 95. So he like just missed Tarantino.
Yeah, he could have been the Gimp or something. Sorry, I hope Gene Kelly's family is not listening to this.
I think Gene Kelly's family probably stopped listening to it when we said he was cuckold.
Yeah, they didn't make it past the cuckolded part. So the part with Gene Kelly is the Gimp in Pulp Fiction. I'm glad they didn't make it that far. Why is Grandpa in the leather suit? What? Why does he have the zipper on the mouth? I don't get
it. It's about the only thing he didn't try on in all of the world. I think there was someone in the background that had that suit on.
Wake up, Gene. Gene's sleeping. I bet you better go wake him up.
Oh, this took a turn.
All right. So Xanadu, the magical place of whimsy and mystery. So it's this big nightclub. There's roller skating. There's all sorts of shenanigans going on. And then Olivia comes out in her slinky little black disco outfit to sing the title track. And I know from previous discussions, one of Jessica's favorite songs of all time.
Man, this song got me pregnant.
Wow.
I mean, it's a banger. This song is great.
Literally a banger if it got you pregnant.
Yes.
This is a good podcast, by the way. This is what's one's fun.
I mean, we're having fun. I don't know if anybody else is gonna.
Okay, so yeah, Olivia comes out. She sings the title track. I will not even begin to try to do justice by singing Xanadu, but it's a very catchy song. I'll play a little clip here. And she will sing this, and it's a really cool song, a very iconic moment. And you know, the movie should have ended on that, but it doesn't.
But it does not. Like, you know, we should slow fade out on this. No, there's like 15 more minutes of genre-spanning crap. There's Fringe. There's more Fringe. I thought we were done with Fringe. No, we're not done with Fringe.
Yeah, it's like the producers just could not trust you end on your title track, which you should. This is the overture. This is where you end the movie. But no, they're like, we need a country song in there. So, yeah, they have a techno dance where Olivia is all of a sudden in a techno outfit dancing with the other muses. Then they have like an old big band one, and then a hard rock where she's in like a sexy tiger outfit where she just is singing these random songs. And then, yeah, then the Western. We decide we're going to end on the Western where she's a cowboy singer.
God, they should have ended on the juggling mimes.
Yeah. This is where I pull out one of my favorite lines from You Are a Mystery Science Theater Fan from Manos, The Hands of Fate, where like an hour and a half into the movie where somebody on one of the bots says, you know, there are certain flaws in this movie.
Yeah, you know, they're the only people that don't know when to end something that might be worse than an SNL sketch writer.
Yes. You end on the title track, the most iconic, one of the most iconic scenes of movies from 1980. You have Olivia singing Xanadu, but no, they do all these other dumb songs. And then I think they realize their mistake and they're like, let's do Xanadu again. And now we end on Xanadu.
Yeah.
And now she's like sparkly. She looks like a goddess now.
Yeah. Well, and then the stinger on the whole thing is like, she's going to go back up to Olympus, but is she? Because now there's a waitress that looks exactly like her.
That's right. We set this up for a sequel.
Yeah. And it's like, it's not her because she doesn't know him anymore. But it is her because it looks just like her. And Gene Kelly's probably going to try to hit on her too.
Well, so now Sonny's banging a clone. Now it's creepy. Now it's Westworld.
Why couldn't she send two of them down?
Yeah. So literally, at the end of the song, Kira, Olivia Newton-John, ascends back up into heaven because she was only down for one night. And then she is reincarnated in the body of a waitress who comes up and talks to Sonny. And he's like, you know, you're not her, but you look just like her, so let's date.
Yeah.
And that's the movie. And that's the end.
That's the end.
And poor Gene Kelly is off in the corner watching these two young people bang like rabbits again.
I don't know. Maybe he's into it. At this point, I think I'm just going to say he's into it. Yep, so there you have it.
And there you have it, Xanadu, the enchanting children's musical movie from 1980 that we have somehow defiled many times over. But again, it's a movie that doesn't work. It shouldn't work at all, and it really doesn't. It's ostensibly quite terrible, but the soundtrack is so good, and you have Olivia Newton-John at her peak, and she's like a huge star, and that ELO music is so good. And the art and the direction and the cinematography and the choreography is all so distinct. Like, it just kind of does work too, in spite of itself.
Yeah, you know what? It's like, I think it's just a lot of really good things that don't taste good together.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, peanut butter and Otoro.
That's exactly the analogy I was going to use, yeah.
I don't know. I was trying to think of like two things I don't ever want to eat together that taste very good. And that's what I came up with. But yeah, and like all of these things, like you take them one at a time and they're just awesome. And then there's like a couple of really bad things in there too.
Yeah.
And then the whole thing is just a fiasco.
It just is. It is, but it's a beloved fiasco. And again, like I said, this movie was not as bad a flop as history has treated it as. It was still maybe a very minor hit, if anything. I mean, it wasn't a huge flop, but it was like embarrassing to say you liked it. And like I said, this is when I go back to the I Love the 80s and all those people like Leah Thompson saying, oh my God, I can't believe Magic, that song. What were you thinking, Olivia? And then she's like, you know what? It was a good song. So all these people were so embarrassed to say they liked this movie, but it's kind of experienced a renaissance over the years that people no longer ironically like it. Now they like actually like it, which is kind of cool because it is a fun movie with it. And it's got a nice heart in the right place, I will say.
Yeah, it's very earnest. Like, I don't think there's no cynicism to this movie. I think there might be some cynicism to how I like it, but I don't think I like anything without cynicism anymore.
Oh, yeah, I agree. Yeah, we're old and jaded now.
Yeah, I'm like all about the irony. But yeah, these people, like, they're really straightforwardly trying to do something.
And the message in the movie is honestly pretty sweet. I mean, if you want to take a step back and just be corny, it's like, you know what? Paint things that make you happy. Live life the way you want. If you want to open a club, do it. If you want to follow your dreams, do it. You might need a little muse's help to do it, but you'll be happier in the long run. So if you want to be corny, it's got a nice message.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can't argue with that.
So yeah. And with that, I think we have successfully covered Xanadu, one of the oddest movies I've ever done on Staff Picks. But I will say, one of the episodes here that I'm most proud of, because I really think we delved into this one in all of its glory in both the good ways and the bad ways, and I was having fun recording it, so hopefully people will enjoy the way when they listen to it, too.
Yeah, and I think they will enjoy it. It's just like us kind of cry laughing for 2 hours, so what's not fun about that?
And I'm proud to say my kids are going to be so horrified that I recorded this episode. They're like, Dad, I cannot believe you told the public that our father likes Xanadu. So I was already on thin ice with my kids to begin with. This is going to be one that breaks the ice, breaks the dam forever.
Yeah. Well, you know, if your kids aren't embarrassed by you, like, what are you even doing with your life?
That's an excellent point. Yeah. They have no idea that I'm naked when I record these.
Well, I didn't know that.
See? No. Anyway, I just want to thank you for joining me again. I always love having you on the show. I think Jessica and I have a unique dynamic that I don't have with everyone, but that's just because we've known each other for like 20 years.
Yeah, that is crazy to me. And yeah, I would like to come on to Staff Picks more often. I know you have a large roster of people, and we were talking about how the sheer spectrum of perspectives and personalities you bring to this show is what makes it great. But honestly, let's not make it 2.5 years next time.
All right. I promise. And I will say one other thing is that I have a bad habit of inviting Jessica on, and we only do Los Angeles movies, so we can talk about all these cool LA locations. You have specifically said, please, can we do a New York movie? Because you are East Coast, and I know nothing about the East Coast. So I need to go into your world one of these days.
Yeah. I will make you a list of New York movies that I think we could have fun with.
Okay. Excellent. And so, yeah, you will be on it well before 2.5 years, probably. So like in a year and a half, I'll contact you again.
Sounds good.
All right. But anyway, yeah. Anything else you want to add about Xanadu, or anything else you want to plug before we sign off here?
I mean, as of this recording, I don't want to date us too much because apparently you like Staff Picks to exist out of time and space in a place where nobody dares to go. I am, as of this recording and probably in perpetuity, I am covering The Amazing Race over at Rob Has a Podcast, and that is the place where I am most often found. And you can also find me on the socials. My social handles are typically Haymaker Hattie.
Excellent. And Rob Has a Podcast, much bigger podcast than this. In fact, some would say that's the place where everyone dares to go.
Yeah. And, you know, it's really exploded in recent years. And sometimes I feel like Rob is the Gene Kelly, like, leading us all on the roller skates.
And so what would that – who are the young people making out in front of him? I didn't want to imply that you and I were. But somewhere there's young people that are cock-blocking Rob and ruining his dream.
You know, there's young upstarts who are really like starting to come into their own as podcasters because of the platform they've had on Rob's podcast. I think maybe Chappelle is like the young people making out in front of Rob.
Okay, so there you go. So Kira is now with Chappelle and Rob hates it.
Except maybe he kind of likes it.
All right. We will end on that note with Gene Kelly being a pervert. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Jessica, for the perfect outro. But yeah, once again, my name is Mario Lanza. This is Staff Picks. If you need to reach me, you can reach me at staffpickspodcast@gmail.com or on Twitter at Mario J. Lanza. And until next time, I'll be out there searching for more movies that deserve more love, and I'll try to find somebody interesting to come on and talk about them. Until then, follow your dreams and always believe in the muse, but don't even think you're going to fall in love with her. I'll talk to you later. Bye.